Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist. The Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and with me, as always, is Coach Chad Timmerman.
Hey, everyone.
And our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And we are going to answer more of your coaching questions today. You can submit those to us at trainerroad.com/podcast. You can go on there, see the latest episodes, see different questions that we've answered, whether it's through the podcast or on our blog. We usually try to pick out one or even two of those questions that we answer and get really in depth, but not too much. Just to give you the practical information there on the blog so then you know how to get faster. That's the goal with this whole thing. You can find this podcast on SoundCloud. You can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you aggregate and listen to your podcasts. And you can leave us ratings and reviews there as well. And we like 5-star ones. If you don't want to leave a 5-star rating, reach out to us first and we'll see if we can make it better. Maybe you don't like my voice or Chad's voice or Nate's voice or something like that.
We'll try to fix it.
We'll try our best. We'll see what we can do. Let's get right into it with JJ's question. He says, first off, and this is a bit of a pat on our backs, so bear with us, but there's a question here, I promise you. So he says, first off, I'd like to give a big thank you to you guys. 1 year ago, I weighed 260 pounds and was in the worst shape of my life. I began mountain biking last May, and I'm sure starting from last May, he became an incredible person after that, I'm sure, because he started mountain biking. That's how it works. So I began mountain biking last May and started using Trainer Road over the winter to keep it going. I lost 75 pounds in the process. Wow. Holy cow, man. That is awesome.
That's a person. He said,
I know. That's impressive. I just competed in my first Cat 3 mountain bike cross country race this weekend and won my age group.
Whoa.
The last mile. It's pretty sweet, right? Yeah. The last mile was a battle, and I took the lead with about 500 meters to go and finished 2 seconds in front of second place. It was epic. I'm a regular listener to the podcast with all the tips, suggestions, and training plans you guys gave. The other guys really didn't stand a chance.
So I just want to, nice. Before you get into the question, that beating somebody by 2 seconds on a long race like that, that is 100% mental. It wasn't that you were two seconds more fit than him, or I'm guessing you're him. It's all mental. And I think indoor training and the intervals, the type of stuff that Chad does, makes like it's mental. It's a mental battle every workout. So just think of that next time you're in that position. It's all mental at that stage.
You wanted it more and you knew you could do it. So very impressive.
Yeah. And it's almost that struggle you go through in every one of your workouts in the week when you don't give up on that interval, but you actually push through. Like one of the things that we've said, when you feel too tired and you want to bail out of an interval, instead of doing something else, just keep going. Just keep going. Just keep trying. Keep trying to make it, because then on race day, when it comes down to sprinting to the line, this is what happens. Like, because you know you've overcame so many moments when you wanted to give up before.
Just one more minute, right? Every minute is just one
exactly.
more minute.
Exactly. So he says, now onto my question. I'm wondering what workout or type of workout would be best to prepare me for the first 3 to 5 minutes of a cross-country mountain bike race. My next race is about 1 mile of nasty, steep, paved uphill at the start before we jump into the single track. Keep up the great work, and thanks again, JJ.
Yeah, so JJ, Jonathan can certainly back me up on this, but that's a common race start in general. It's especially common for mountain bike races, cross-country races. And for that reason, if you look at the cross-country specialty plans, they all include something of that nature where there's a really hard start, like 150, 180% of threshold, different durations. But obviously, you're not going to hold power that high for that long. So maybe up to a minute, and then you settle into something that's painfully sustainable. You know, you can do it. You'd like to back off more, but if you do, it means, you know, people are either going to come around you or either way, you're going to lose your position. There's a lot of those workouts in that plan. If you're looking for particular names, it's like Megantic, Richardson, Crane, Augusta, Vancouver, those are all ones that will work. But the idea is that you put in a big, not necessarily explosive, but certainly high-end anaerobic effort, and then follow it with something that's real close to threshold, just far enough below it where you're just hanging in there.
So, two, this has got a lot to do with warm-up before the race, right? To be able to hit that at the beginning.
Absolutely, right? Yeah. So you certainly don't want to do like some light aerobic workout knowing that you're going to have to go full throttle as soon as the the gun fires. So absolutely, your warm-up has to include something similar in nature, where maybe you don't do exactly that, but you absolutely want to include some very high-end efforts, you know, whether they're 10, 20, or 30 seconds, or even 5 to 8, probably more anaerobic efforts, ones that load up your muscles and ramp up your breathing and elevate your heart rate a lot.
Didn't we just do a blog post about this, Jonathan?
We did. Yeah, we did. We actually wrote it. Yeah, and it's really for this purpose because of I primarily focus on mountain bike racing. And you know, JJ, the race that you're talking about reminds me of one that we have in this area. If you're ever in the Tahoe area, it's Squaw Valley. It's a famous ski resort. And they had this start where you started out and you had maybe 150 meters of just a short little road. And that instantly turned into a fire road that averaged, I think it averaged 13%, and it was about 1.2 miles. And that was your first welcome to hell start on that race. And it was absolutely brutal. It had watersheds in between there too, which a lot of climbs are going to have. They'll have little spots where a watershed is essentially like a trench that's diagonally cut into the trail or road. And then it's got like a hill on one side and a trench on the other, and it's to stop water from just coming straight down the road, but actually channel it off. So you've got this super steep start, and then you're going to have constant interruptions where you're actually going to have to go over your limits even harder to get over those. I personally, and you can see on that blog, we actually have workouts that are suggested, and Paw Raw is the warm-up that would be more along the lines of what you're probably looking for. Something we mentioned in that blog post too. So if you use Trainer Road, then we have warm-ups built in that you can, or we have warm-up workouts. You can just sort by warm-up and you can find them that way. But we also suggest that you custom tailor those if you want to see what works. If something works, you know, if you find that just tweaking it in a certain way works a little better, then you can change that and save the workouts too and use that. Or if you don't use Trainer Road, there are a number of different ways to make sure you warm up for this. I think Chad pretty much covered the interval structure that you want to have, those race start intervals that start out hard and then, but keep you sitting at a high intensity after that. But with the warm up side of things, I know if I don't have a trainer and if I don't have anything else by me there to do a good warm up, which by the way, for mountain biking is so important because it's hard to find in most cases, like a consistent road when you're at a mountain bike race start to do a warm up on. But if you don't have that, then try to find a climb that you can repeat and that you can put out similar efforts in a consistent fashion where you're not going to be screwing up the operation of the race. Chad, I know you've raced a good chunk of mountain bikes. Nate, you just raced your first mountain bike race not long ago. But Chad, what did you do to warm up, like in practical, when we're talking about the application, how did you warm up before a race? Did you do it on the trainer or did you do it going up the hills or find a flat road?
Yeah, I almost always pack a trainer just in the event that I'm not going to have any segment of course to warm up on. The few times that I haven't brought a trainer, that's sabotaged me. In fact, Jonathan was with me when we had to go do a criterium and they had this little tiny parking lot that we were supposed to warm up in. It was pointless. I mean, you could ride around in circles at maybe 50% threshold. So is why bother? So I always have a trainer with me whenever possible because you never know.
What about for mountain biking though?
Same thing. Mm-hmm. No, I definitely set
how do you
a
hook
trainer.
It up?
Either with a wheel off design like the kicker, or you just deal with the knobby noise on a roller and you have to ride very smoothly. Or you can bring an extra wheel with a slick tire on it.
Yeah, a lot of people use rollers too. And the noise thing is just going to happen. It's going to be loud and that's okay. As long as you're getting in the type of structure that you can get, then mm-hmm. it's certainly much better than just picking a road.
Yeah, it still works. It still works.
One thing that I've, if I could pre-ride the course, this is probably because I'm more new. It's like warming up my skills too. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If I can see it once, then I can the second time I can hit it twice as fast.
If you have that option, but a lot of the times the race is going on or it's simply close to competitors.
If you can't get there the day before to pre-ride it, and then I would definitely recommend pre-riding a course in the morning. Cross-country mountain bike racing or cyclocross is usually very easy because the course is pretty short. It just, like Chad said, it depends if the race is already going on because it can be tough to access it that way. But if you can, I really like that strategy that you said, Nate. In most cases, unless it's like a national championships race or state championships, if it's something that's on a more local scale, you can usually, as long as you get there early, get in a lap around the course. Now, when I get in that lap on the course, like Nate said, I'm not focusing on warming up from a training perspective as much as I am getting my skills in place and memorizing the course. Much like slalom racing with ski, you know, you see ski racers at the top of a run, they've got their eyes closed and their hands are like their skis and they're kind of walking through their run and they're going side to side. You can see that. The same thing with a mountain bike race. You really want to memorize the course because when things bunch up, if you know of a spot to go left and take a section of single track that may be more tough, but it's an option to get around everyone that's stuck in the right, it can really pay off. So I always do that and kind of use that if I can. I use that as more my general warm-up to get my body warmed up for the warm-up. And then I go on the trainer and get in my structure and make sure that it's really dialed in. There are exceptions and it's a really long loop though. If it's a really long loop, you know, a 30-mile loop, then I'm not going to go pre-ride that whole thing the morning before the race. So
my next question is, so at the beginning of this race, he said he's got 5 minutes, maybe a 5-minute climb before he gets in single track. How hard, maybe I want both of your guys' answers. We'll start with Chad. How hard should he go for those 5 minutes to kind of break, you know, get into his position without blowing up for the single track? That's something that I've struggled with.
It's gonna be dictated by the other riders out there, but ideally past that first initial explosive-ish effort, you know, maybe 30 seconds to a minute where you're really fighting for position, once you settle in, it's gonna have to be something close to and probably below threshold. You might be able to push it over threshold, but it all depends on, you know, what comes next. If you're already just bathing in muscle burn, and then you still have to hold that for, you know, you get a short downhill and then you know you got another long uphill, you're screwed. And so what comes after is gonna influence just how hard you can attack it, but it's gonna be somewhere very close to threshold, either a little above it, a little below it.
Yeah, I completely agree with Chad. Those are really good points. The fact that it's relative to what the pack is doing, because on that first climb, now, JJ, you won this last race, so maybe when you head out to this next one, when you take off, you might be the leader, right? And in that case, as long as you're in the lead, I wouldn't try to get too big of a lead there. I would more focus on staying within yourself but making sure you're in good position, because then, like Chad said, on the subsequent climbs that come up, if you make sure that you haven't gone too deep, then you'll be able to really put it into them and get some time there. But all about positioning, for me personally, climb number one is positioning. I just focus on making sure I get a solid position as close as I can to the front, if not the front. And then, like Chad said, I do everything I can to try to optimize everything, because if I need to recover before we hit hard again.
So. Yeah, because this is a long race, right? It's not a 5-minute race. It's like an hour or more race. So yep. I like what you said, Jonathan. Get a solid position. It's like on my first race, I was like a triathlete. I'm going to pace this thing evenly. And I was in a horrible position. No. And people were just stopping on the trail. There were a lot less places to pass than I thought there would, at least in the race that I did, which was very frustrating.
Yeah. You know, there's one kid an athlete here locally. He races for the Bear Development Team, which is a really prestigious team. His name's Tate, and he was a junior, and last year at every race, he took off so hard, and he would tear everyone's legs off, you know? He was sprinting, and then he would end up, in most cases last year, sometimes it worked out, but in most cases, he would blow up. He's much better now at managing this, but in most cases, he would blow up, and the race would end up not going so well, but at first, everyone wanted to follow him, and then everyone that followed him would just end up getting blown up too. Now, really, if you have one guy that you know is a fast rider and he's just going off the front, don't worry about that, especially if you know that he's a good technical rider and he's not going to be holding you up later on in a technical section like Nate was talking about. Don't worry about that. You can let that guy go. But in relation to the rest of the pack, you just want to be up as close as you can toward the front of that pack. It's so important with mountain biking and cyclocross for that matter. So, all right, let's go into Dale's question. He says, "Hey there, I currently ride in a coach-led group on Mondays and want to know how to best incorporate trainer road into my duathlon training." Chad, you've been a duathlete, right?
I have, yeah. And I've also coached riders where I wish I had something like trainer road where I could require that they were on the trainer a couple days a week. workouts that I could devise and then roll out to them through, you know, in our case, our Teams function, and then get those files quite easily and take a look at them and like really go to work on what they're doing rather than have to work one-on-one with them or in a group setting where you can only kind of work with a couple writers at a time. So Dale, my advice would be to create a team. I'm assuming you're using Trainer Road. Well, yep, that's the question. Create a team and, like I said, roll out specific workouts to your riders and then monitor those workouts, see how well they're working, because even the same workout across the board is going to work differently for different riders, and you can tweak each of them as you progress through the season based on how each rider is responding to the training.
And Chad means by create a team inside of Train Road, you can create a team and put workouts in there, and then those will be shared, so you can create a custom workout or use some of Chad's workouts and share them with other people on the team and see what rides they're doing.
Exactly.
Yep. Yeah, that's the easy way to do it. Is there anything specific, Chad, that you would... Now, we don't have duathlon-specific plans, but is there any type of suggestions that you would usually give to a duathlete when you talk about like adapting our training plan? Should they pick a triathlon plan, or should they go with a cycling plan, then just incorporate running on their own?
That's a good question, and it'll be probably decided mostly based on what they're already good at. If they're already real strong runners, then I might have them do a cycling-specific plan and try to fold their running into it in more of a maintenance mode than anything. And if they're kind of weak in both sports, a triathlon plan minus the swims, of course, would probably be a better fit because they're pretty equally weighted in the case of the tri plans.
Awesome. Greg, hi team, setting up my pain cave. And pain cave, for those that don't know, that's jargon for the room where they will train. And pain cave is a pretty gnarly way to think of it, but that's generally, you know, for those that know accurate. What it's like training and suffering, it's about accurate. So he says, I'm setting up my pain cave and attaching a small TV to the wall in front of my bike. This is a very, very detailed question here, very nuanced, specific thing. But he says, do you have guidance for the best height for a screen?
Yes.
Yeah, it's actually Greg.
What do all three of us do?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Super good question. And I've got similar setup. I have the luxury of a large screen. Just, you know, TVs get replaced. We kept a pretty big one. So I've set it up. I actually made the mistake of setting it too high, which, of course, you're going to crane your neck and it just gets uncomfortable. But realistically, you want it in line with the horizon. You basically want to emulate what you're going to experience when you're outdoors. And that's a head that's basically focused on the horizon. You're not looking down at your wheel and you're not always trying to look up over other riders. So I line it up so that the midline of the screen is in line with where the horizon would be if I'm looking, you know, maybe 20 feet out. So just a couple feet off the ground so I don't have to cant my head upward and strain the back of my neck.
What about you, Nate?
Yeah, so I don't know where, I never mounted a TV too high, but that's been my biggest concern is mounting it too high. Especially if you're on a TT bike, if you go too high, like you're not going to be able to stay in your TT position, putting your head up so high. So I think I have mine where the bottom of my screen is actually a little bit lower than my handlebars. And I also, it's like a 50 inch that I have in my training room. So it's a little bit bigger, but I find that's pretty good where I'm not, you know, looking down all the way. And if I'm my TT bike, I definitely have to look forward like I'm on the road. But again, like I see so many people, especially on Slow Twitch, someone will mount their TV and show it and everyone's like, that's too high. And then like a week later, it'll come up again. There'll be two huge holes up above and then they'll put it down.
But on the flip side of that, if you're maybe looking at an iPad or a laptop and you've got it set under you and you're always looking down. I mean, it's just not something that transfers very well to outdoor riding. So I like to put it somewhere that forces me to put my head in a position that I'm going to use outdoors.
I was just going to say that when I first started out, I remember I had a chair and that chair would just butt up to my front wheel. It was a lower chair and I had my computer set on that. Once I brought it outside after a lengthy winter and a lot of indoor time training, I remember thinking, my goodness, the hardest part about cycling is just looking up because I was so used to staring down, you know? And I see that a lot on Instagram and everything else when people send in pictures, which we always enjoy that, by the way, seeing like how your training area is set up. A lot of people use ironing boards. And if you use an ironing board, then you have the luxury of like kind of testing out beforehand how high you want the screen to be, because generally most ironing boards have adjustable height, which is cool. But I see a lot of people with their iPads or their phones or something else down low. And if you can, try to get it up so you can see it a little higher. That definitely helps if you have a secondary screen like that. I know for us in our house, we have a low couch in the living room and our TV is actually high. So when you're laying down on the couch, it's fantastic because it pushes you kind of back into the couch and it's comfortable. But if I were to train in my living room, it'd be terrible because I'd be looking up so much. I'd just be killing my neck. So yeah, whatever. I always think of, because when you're riding in a group, I always look at the person's shoulders, just beyond their shoulders. My point of view crosses their shoulders and goes ahead. But the shoulders in front of me is what I look at. That way I can see movements and intentions to move long before their wheels are locking up, if I'm just staring at their wheels. So I think if the TV is right there, wherever those shoulders would be, unless you're riding with somebody like Nate, that's a massively tall human, shoulders of the person, if that's where you're looking, I think you're set. So
at the office at Trainer Road, we have stand-up desks, which means we have a little motor and we can choose the height. And when I train here, I put my handlebars just barely under the bottom of the desk, and then I have a computer screen on the desk, and the difference between that's about 8 inches, and that feels really good for a road bike. So another point of reference.
Yeah, and actually, this is a little beside the point, but still relates. As far as getting used to a head position that you're going to use outdoors, I see a lot of people adapt to a really arrow position, and I've made this mistake myself, where I feel like, wow, I am slippery. My head's so low, it's totally in front of my body. I'm going to be so fast this year. I'm not even going to have to work that hard. I'm so arrow. And then I put my helmet on, and everything goes out the window. I have to bring my head up high. My body position changes. I'm super uncomfortable really early on. So if you're tweaking your position, and this kind of relates to the screen you're looking at, and you want to make sure that this isn't in fact a sustainable position, put your helmet on once in a while. Just make sure that this position is something I can actually do when I have whatever helmet I plan to wear on my head.
For those early podcast listeners, you should tape some yams to the top of your helmet while you wear it inside to get your neck strong.
That's like a... Yeah, don't worry about the guy. Exactly right. Don't worry about looking lame inside. If you're using your helmet, don't worry. Just don't let anybody put you
outside's
on YouTube and
different.
You're good. Yeah, yeah.
Jonathan will berate me for a 6-inch sock instead of a 7-inch.
This is true. Yeah, I'm pretty particular to a fault. The other thing that I think is going to be brought up, or a lot of people, some of you are probably thinking, is, well, hold on, I have my iPhone on my bars. You might have a quad lock, or you might have even that case mount we have on our blog. We have like a walkthrough on how to make a homemade case that just twist locks into your Garmin. Pretty cheap and easy. So if you have your Garmin there, I think that's a good opportunity for you to train for how to look at your cycling computer when you're outside. There's a whole Tumblr dedicated to Chris Froome looking at his stem, which he doesn't love his stem. He looks at data a lot. and if you look at that, he's constantly looking down, glancing up, but it's not as if he's riding, looking down at the thing all the time. I do feel like you should use that kind of as a training mechanism to glance down, but to continue focus ahead. Chad, I know you train with your phone on your mm-hmm. bike a lot of the time, especially when you're here in the office. Are you staring down at the thing the whole time, or how do you manage your head position with that?
It's just like outdoors where you have a computer and it's just a reference. You look at it every once in a while. Yep, I am in fact going that hard, or nope, I'm not going hard enough, sort of thing. But in no way do I stare at it. I don't do it indoors, and I certainly don't do it outdoors.
Well, I think this is maybe even the setup Greg could have is a lot of people have the iPhone on their handlebars, mm-hmm. and then they have a big TV. They're watching like cable or something else, and they look at both at the same time, and that's a good... Like you said, Jonathan, good training to look at both.
Right, absolutely. And granted, if you're in the middle of like a ramping interval or some type of interval structure with very short intervals that requires your attention, you'll mm-hmm. be looking at it more frequently. But that's okay. Hit your power targets. That's what matters most. So, and it makes it very easy with the smart trainer, by the way. So you just have to not die. Damien, he says, there's been a lot of discussion on the podcast about which trainers simulate best actual road conditions regarding inertia. He says, is this really something relevant? I feel like we've kind of beat that one to a dead horse, or beat that dead horse quite a lot. So I'm not going to go directly into that, because his next question kind of like strays away from that, or the body of his real question strays away from it. I feel like it is relevant. but that's my two cents. Having said that, it's not going to negate the value of your training if you're training in a different gear. You're still going to get a lot of value from it. So anyways, he says, I used a cheap trainer with little inertia for years, and it forced me to keep a smooth pedal stroke with constant pressure on the pedals. He's probably talking about something like a mag trainer, maybe. I don't know, or maybe a wind trainer. But when I think of that, mag trainers definitely have that feeling. Mm-hmm. He says, I now switch to an... Sorry, Jonathan. Go ahead.
In general, mag trainers are like that. They have really low inertia. But wind trainers, even though they're inexpensive... No, wind trainers are usually good. They usually have a really high inertia. The Le Mans Revolution is very high. And even the Cyclops wind trainer is a pretty good road feel. Although the thing is dangerous as heck. Like, there's just crazy, open blades. Right? Yeah, and it's really loud.
It sounds scary. Like a small plane. It's not that much of an exaggeration, really. It is extremely loud.
I've never used a wind trainer.
Yeah. He says, I now switch to an expensive Kurt Kinetic with a heavy flywheel. It has a better road-like feel, but I can't do effective single-leg drills with it. Chad, I wanted to get your thoughts on this. So suddenly, he's going from having a lot of constant resistance with a mag trainer, or we assume to be a mag, to a trainer that has more inertia behind it.
So, Damien, I'm guessing you've actually really adapted to a low inertia trainer, at least when it comes to your single leg drills and maybe when both legs are locked in, to the point where you're riding specifically for that trainer and you've cultivated habits that don't lend to something that you could actually apply outdoors. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is totally debatable, but I think you've just gotten really used to your trainer.
And this is something interesting because the hard part about single leg drills for me isn't it really the slack point. It's having tension on the chain all the way around. Mm-hmm. That's the hard part, is keeping it smooth. So it's what Damien's running into now. When I have a trainer that has constant resistance, it makes it a little easier for me to do that. I have to make sure that I'm not pushing too hard and using too much body English or letting my knee flare out at the top of the pedal stroke, but it makes it a little easier when you have constant resistance to have that constant chain tension.
Yeah. I have two points here. One, single leg drills are just a drill. It's not actually how you're going to race. And I wouldn't buy a trainer based on how good single leg drills I can do. Second, this is actually exposing a flaw. So if single leg drills, we're trying to get you to pedal all the way around the stroke. And what you're doing, and because it's a high inertia trainer, you're pushing very high in that first quadrant on the downstroke with your quad. And there's so much built up inertia that you're having, like Jonathan said, slack then on when you're pulling down from the bottom and picking up. And so to fix that, you're going to have to push down less on that first quadrant and have more power on the backstroke. Is that right, Chad?
Yeah, I think he's overcompensating in the stronger parts of the pedal stroke to get through the weaker parts of the pedal stroke. And that's put him in a place where he's now maybe a little too strong in those aspects of the pedal stroke where you really don't need a whole lot of strength.
Yeah, and it's a subconscious thing too, Damien. I doubt that you're consciously thinking, I need to push really hard here to carry the momentum. It's just how you pedal, and it's how you've gotten used to it. But that can change. It's not something that is, constant and set. You can change that.
Chad, I think we said two different things. I said that he's pushing too hard at the beginning, and I think you said that he's being too strong on the back. But
I think we're in agreement. I think he's pushing too hard on the downstroke, and then maybe pulling too hard on the back and upstroke. So either way, he's pushing too hard.
I gotcha.
Okay.
He's got a dead spot in the bottom there. So Damien, the Kurt Kinetic trainer that you have with that heavy flywheel, the one that's got more inertia, it might be the best thing to happen to your single leg drills in a long time. So it'll make you work on them and refine them even more. And just to clarify too, I think we mentioned this before, but I know a lot of people, because they're I've seen GCN as in a YouTube video, and a bunch of other people have talked about how pedaling, with constant pressure is quantifiably not as efficient for a person to pedal, or I should say it's a less efficient way for a person to pedal than however they're used to pedaling, which if we phrase the question in that respect, it's pretty straightforward and seems like we don't even need to ask it, right? However you're used to, that's where you're going to perform usually best. But that's not really what we're trying to do, right, Chad? We're not trying to necessarily make everybody pedal the same.
No, we're simply trying to pull people away from a mashing pedaling pattern. So people who are just fully quad intensive and just drill it down, and then pretty much that's it. And then just fry their quads, and there's not a lot of contribution from the rest of the muscles. If we can just kind of involve them, they don't have to strongly or obviously contribute. We just don't want it to be all about a downstroke and then basically let the other leg carry around to that next downstroke.
Yeah, well said. Well said, Chad. Carl, he says, "Hi, guys. I love the podcast. I have a new baby coming in about 6 weeks." We're hey. Twins, Carl. Yeah, we're so twins. Yeah, I'm right there. So pretty exciting stuff. He says, "When my oldest son was born, I attempted to start an indoor training program, figuring it would be easier to squeeze in over nap times and early mornings." This is... That's my thought, and that's exactly what I anticipated your thought to be, Nate.
Now, all the dads and moms on this are laughing.
He says, "However, I quickly discovered just how loud some of these turbo trainers really are." I hope he didn't have a wind trainer, because my goodness. He says, "In a relatively small house, it was impossible to train without waking the baby up in the next room. We have a larger house at the moment, but I was wondering if you had any recommendations for a reasonable indoor trainer that doesn't sound like a jet taking off."
Let me just jump in. I don't have a whole lot to contribute. Just to say, this is why I haven't trained on a wind trainer, because I've seen them before. I've definitely heard them. They're crazy loud. So if you're starting with a wind trainer, it's only going to get better.
Mm. Yeah, no doubt. Nate, you lead with this one.
Yeah. So first, sound machines are your friends. My kids still sleep with sound machines, and I think that really helps. So that what a sound machine is, we have, I forget what one, but it plays a couple different songs. It'll play white noise, and that will just kind of make it so when other noise comes up, the baby doesn't hear it as well. And then for trainers, there's different price points, right? So the Tax electronic one just came out, and that one is really silent, right? Jonathan, you wrote that one recently. That one's
The Neo is extremely, extremely
It's like
quiet.
You only hear your drivetrain.
Yeah, I wrote that for a week. It's dead quiet.
Mm-hmm. For less expensive ones that I think are still really high quality are the KirkConnect Row Machine and the Cyclops Jet Fluid Pro. Both of those, they're still pretty quiet. I think that with a sound machine in the kid's room, and just clean your drivetrain too and make sure that's because the squeaky drivetrain can be, you know, that piercing kind of noise.
Totally.
Both of those would be good. And actually, mag trainers are really quiet too. We're not fans of mag trainers, but if your choice is no training or mag trainer, totally do a mag trainer. Stay away from anything wind. You could also do a kicker in a really low gear. So if you're on a kicker and you're in a high gear, it's going to be very loud. But if you're in a kicker in the lowest gear, it'll be very quiet. Probably close to the
tax. Yeah, you hear your drivetrain more than you hear the trainer, for sure. I was going to say a couple things there. A lot of the time we excuse the noise or we blame the trainer for the noise, but we're doing a lot to make that noise worse. Tires, make sure that you have a tire. So some trainer tires can be quiet. Some trainer tires can be actually pretty loud. But in most cases, like for example, I know Kinetic has a trainer tire that's just a slick. It's very good. If your tire has any type of relief on it, like even if you have something like a Continental, hopefully you're not training with a Continental GP, you know, GP 4000 S2 or something like that, a really expensive race tire on there. But if you do, those do have relief, and any type of relief will make noise. So
what do you mean by relief?
What I mean by relief is any type of tread pattern. Doesn't mean it has to have knobs like a mountain bike, but any type of bumps, dimples, cross hatching, whatever it may be, to get water out, whatever it is, that's going to make your trainer louder, because the tire there, every time that rubber is having that void and then closing that up, it's going to make it louder. So if you can ride with the slick, that's number one. Number two, clean your drivetrain. I could, like Nate said about the 6-inch versus 7-inch sock, you haven't even seen my particular nature until it comes to cleaning my bike.
He waxes his mountain bike tires. Like, what kind of wax do you put on your tires? It's like the tire shine that you'd put on like your Escalade or something. He does that to his whole tire every time.
Not every time. I do it about once a month, and it's Carnauba wax, and that just conditions the rubber a bit. And the only reason I do that is so then the tires that they don't, because tires get dried and cracked out. So it just keeps them a little more
moist.
You
want it to look good.
And that's the that's
the second reason,
a bigger part. Yeah, or let's just say that's the first. Let's be real. But anyways, cleaning your drivetrain and making sure it's clean is going to go a long way to making your bike more quiet. Adjust your derailleurs so then you're not getting chain rub. Do the little things to make your bike quiet, and that's going to help no matter what trainer you have. But then one trainer that
save watts too, right? That's going to save watts.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, and you'll be a lot cooler. You'll just be a great person having a clean thing. So the other trainer that I was going to mention that we haven't mentioned are Elite trainers. The Elite Turbo Muin is really quiet, like really, really quiet. It's on par, I think, with the Neo, maybe a little louder than the Neo, but hardly at all. And then they also have, like, Elite has a line of fluid trainers with some elastogel. Instead of like a metal spindle, it's actually got like a, it's like a rubber kind of gel like spindle. And that is extremely quiet. My dad has one of those trainers and he's able to watch TV while working out and it's no issue at all. He doesn't have to crank the volume up. So
the two other things I would say is, how your house is, built. So if you could go to a garage, so if you're like, I live on a slab, so that means I have a concrete floor all the way across my single story. But if you have a like a basement or you're on wood, that can kind of vibrate the house. If you have a big fan, where you put that fan too, if that's on, you know, plywood and it's a wood house, that can cause vibrations. So if you can get a baby monitor and go to like your garage where it's concrete, then the vibrations won't go as far and it'll be a lot quieter. And then with that, just be careful with your fan. I know we really like big fans, but again, if your choice is between not training or having like a medium to small size fan that doesn't vibrate as much. We mounted some fans in the office here on the, we mounted 3 20-inch Air Kings, which are like industrial fans on a wall. And you turn that on and we're in the basement of like a 4-story office building. You could hear it like anywhere in the entire building. It hit some rebar and just went, I think it hit the elevator and
it's
just
like
shook.
It's like you're working out inside of a turbine.
Yeah, it's like a jack. It sounded like someone had a jackhammer outside.
Totally does. Yeah, we need, if we could balance the fans, I'm sure that it would be quieter. You know, I'm sure it would be better. But
we put them on the floor now, and it's a lot better,
much better.
Yeah, no doubt. Is there anything else to consider when you're talking about working out with kids? I mean, this is in my near future, so I'm going to be selfish. And Nate, I know you have experience with this, but yeah. What else should we do when you're training and you have little ones? What are things that we should do to take into consideration?
Switch. Well, so happy wife, happy life, right? If you can take your kids, especially if you're a runner, if you can take your kid on a run in a stroller, that's awesome. A lot of I really like the Bob strollers. They have like a, you can, in the winter, you can put a whole like, sorry, I'm talking about running, but you can put a whole like cocoon over them. It's like this plastic thing you can put on over them and you put a blanket and they're just happy. And my wife still does that. I've actually done a lot of trainer rides with the kids in the US. We have these things called pack and plays, which are these like portable cribs. And then you can put your kid in there and I just have the kid fall asleep while I'm riding. So there's not like a change in noise. They'll just be in there. They'll play with some toys or they'll have some milk and then they'll fall asleep. I wear headphones for the TV. So I have these wireless headphones. I forget I can't say the name.
Sennheiser.
Yeah, I think it's the RS120s. I forget, but they're really good wireless TV headphone that has no lag. And I wear those when I train too. So you don't have that TV sound going through because I think that's something that could wake up the kids. Where constant noise really didn't wake up my kids. It's when there'd be someone where like someone would ring the doorbell or slam a door or something on the TV and an explosion would happen on TV. That would be enough change that would wake them up. And a lot of times too, they're just going to wake up. You'll think it's you, but they just wake up all the time. So maybe do intervals and let them cry for a little bit. It's okay. They'll survive. I got this interval, honey. Give me 1 minute. Now that's a whole nother parenting thing. But as you, when they're very young, they need a lot of food. But then as they get older, if you're always going to them for every cry, even in the middle of the night, it's going to be a rough life. And we did that for my first starter. It was hard. My son, you know, my second kid, we didn't do that, and we're just like, he's fine. He'll be, you know, he'll survive in the morning. We'll feed him in the morning, and then he just started sleeping through the night and everyone's lives were better. We made it hard with our daughter. It was all us.
So what about a stroller with riding with kids? Not a stroller, but a trailer. That's kind of sketchy to me. I see a lot of people riding with them on bike paths or something like that. Totally makes sense. But on the road, it seems a little sketchy. You don't do that, do you, Nate?
I'll only do it on bike paths, and I won't do it on the road.
And you're not training then.
Yeah, I'm not training. We'll do it to like go to the park, which is fun. And the one that we have, strollers can get expensive. But the good thing is they have good resale value. Is we have what's called the Chariot, and Thule just bought that. The thing that's cool about that is it can be a running stroller, a walking stroller. You can get a rickshaw attachment, so you can go on hikes. We have the double.
Nice.
You can also get, I did this, cross-country skis for it. So we went snowshoeing, pulling the kids in the trailer, and I tried to hook my fat bike up to it to pull the kids, but I was only able to go one day last year on that, and the snow was too deep. And it also has a bike attachment. So
cool.
It's just an expensive trailer. You can get a much cheaper, I think the best combo is if you have one kid, get a single bob or double bob if you're a runner, and then just get another bike stroller that's good. Or you could go all in with the Chariot, but I believe that the bob is a better running stroller than the Chariot. I talk about this all day. It's like the dad podcast.
Carl, I think you got more than you bargained for on that one, and I'm probably to blame. So... but to recap really quick on your core question, the Tax Neo is the expensive one, but probably the quietest one that we've seen. The Robe Machine is not bad. If you're going to use a kicker, do so in a low gear. And for that matter, every electronic trainer, I think beside the Neo, is going to be quieter when you're in a lower gear. The Neo has a different system to it, so you won't have that. And then Elite has some pretty cheap trainers that are pretty quiet. Mag trainers can be quiet or loud, but if you can, try to stay away from a mag trainer. You'll get better training out of it. So John, he says, I just completed Ironman Texas last weekend, and there is no way, and that's in all caps, no way I could have completed it without you guys. Thanks, man.
Congrats,
it's good
man.
To hear, John.
It's a hard race.
Trainer Road not only gave me the structure to increase my FTP and aerobic endurance, but allowed me to get 4 and 5 hour rides in during winter weather and darkness, all in the safety and comfort of my garage. You're an animal, John. 4 and 5 hour rides are gnarly.
Yes.
That's rough. I averaged, in fact, Chad was just talking about staying in his TT position for 30 minutes.
30 minutes.
I was impressed. So
count it.
I averaged 19 miles an hour on my Ironman ride, and he says this is great for me, a 40-plus age grouper, and still had plenty of strength and energy left over for a respectable marathon run afterward. I can't thank you enough. When someone asks, how did you train for your Ironman, I tell them all you need is Trainer Road. Well, thanks, John.
Nice.
Yeah, that's solid stuff. It's like you're angling for payroll right there. So a question for Chad. After a few weeks of recovery from Ironman, I have 14 weeks until an Olympic try on Labor Day. I figured I would skip the base phase and do a 6-week build and an 8-week specialty phase. So two questions. Number one, is it better to skip the base and do a full build and specialty phase? Or should I do a full base and build and cut the specialty phase short? Do you want to answer that one before the second one, Chad?
Yeah, that's good. Cool. First off, John, it sounds like a pretty good plan already. You got 6 weeks of build, 8 weeks of specialty. That in and of itself will work. When it comes to revisiting base, you're coming off a race, so that's fully not a concern, especially if you spend those couple of weeks, which is kind of what the second part of your question addresses. You're going to spend those couple of weeks doing something light and aerobic anyway. So base fitness isn't going to slip. Don't worry about base. And same goes for experienced athletes. I mean, the more fitness you carry annually, so year to year, the more your base training can come down and probably should. You can spend your time in better ways. I mean, you get to a point where if you're kind of just coming into each year with still a fair amount of fitness, you can reduce your base season as far down as 4 weeks. I mean, a simple month of base and you're right back in there. So especially in your case, you're basically doing a rebuild. So you're just revisiting a part of your build to kind of prep you for the specialty. And I would keep the whole specialty because it's the most specialized training you're going to encounter. And secondly, because it includes a taper, which will set you up really nicely for your subsequent race.
This is really awesome. Nice too, that he said, yes, I'm going to recover from my Ironman, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people are like, no, crucial. I'm just going to race.
Yeah, and I think he said something about after taking off a couple weeks or a few weeks, which is a great idea because those things take a heavy, heavy toll.
Yeah, for those who don't know, Ironman races, really fast guys who are age groupers, around 10 hours, all the way up to 17 hours. And some of that can just be the most miserable time of your life. It just
if it's 17 hours, it was probably a miserable day.
You know what? Actually, I think some of the people in those like 10 to 13 is a little harder because 17, although it can be, I mean, it is still really hard, but at 17, you can pretty much walk the whole marathon. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, there's a difference between slogging or running and feeling like you're going to die, but still running an entire marathon and doing like a 4-hour marathon where it just feels awful to walking a marathon. Yeah. Walking a marathon's still hard. I mean, it's still extremely hard, but
sounds that terrible to me. Yeah.
Either way, right?
Yeah. Just it all sounds going really bad.
you guys, for those who haven't done Ironman, you could think of like doing a 112 mile bike ride and how you feel, and then being like, I'm going to go walk 26.2 miles. 2. Oh, I got it wrong for a second. Yeah, 26.2 miles. It just doesn't sound like fun.
No.
We
have
Olympic halves. Those are fun.
We have one of the best age grouper ex-Terra athletes in actually the world, really, named Matt Balzer. He's from here in Reno, and he jumps into our road races, hangs right with the front group, sprints to the finish, wins sometimes. He's just an animal. And then he always unclips and then puts his running shoes on and runs while we've still got our tongues in the spokes. Makes us all feel fantastic, Matt. So, so his second question. One quick thing, just on the point of recovery, just to nail it home. I think Garmin's are completely off with this. I don't know if you guys have seen this on the new Edge 520s and everything else, but
yes.
When you finish a ride, like I finished like a 2-hour ride last week. And it was pretty easy. And I've got a power meter, so it's got an accurate indication of how much effort I put out. And it told me I needed something like 36 hours to recover before my next workout, right? Way over the top. When you're looking at this type of stuff, though, with an Ironman event that you've completed, it's if you're trying to look on which side to err, it's probably best to err on the side of conservative, you know, more recovering more. It's a huge task to ask of your body. It's rough.
And age and experience. Some guys can go like 1 week, kind of like they do a couple of swims, mm-hmm. easy rides, and they're back at it. But then, you know, 40 plus, it depends too how hard the Ironman was for you. If you did end up walking half of it or if you ran the whole thing, it's so you can't just say, oh, 2 weeks every time or 1 week every time.
Yeah, there's that Iron Cowboy guy. I don't know what his name is, but he did insane amounts of Ironmans back to back, but he's simply, I just don't know if he's human. I don't know. It's crazy. Impressive stuff. But anyways, on to the second question that he has here. He says, what type of workout should I be doing during my 2 weeks of Ironman recovery? Thanks.
So John, I almost always steer people to, in Trent Rose's case, the traditional base plans. Just because that's what you need. You just need aerobic maintenance. You're not looking to further your fitness. You're simply looking to hold on to some of your, you know, most of your aerobic adaptation while you let your body heal. And that's exactly what's going on. So I can't push the point enough that when you think of recovery, think of healing. You've damaged your body and now it needs to heal. So it's not recovery. It's not superfluous or unnecessary. It's very necessary. You're reversing damage, and you can do that at different levels of effort. So if you're new to triathlon, if it took a particularly heavy toll on you, you just haven't got much in the tank, like traditional base one is a great way to go. The intensity is low, the efforts are steady. Definitely omit the sprints. There's a couple sprints sprinkled in there, no reason to do those. And then just kind of work your way up from there. If you feel like you can handle a little more stress, base two, a little more stress than that, base three, but it's going to be dictated based on how you feel. So you hop on the bike and you realize you're just tired, then what you're doing may be a little too much. Try to downgrade.
And I know the rule of thumb is usually people the first day after their Ironman, they'll do like a 30-minute easy swim. A lot of people don't do any runs until the very end of that first week because that's the most damaging, and then they'll do what Chad said, which are the easy rides. Can we talk a little bit, just because this is my own selfish thing, about injury?
Yeah.
This is kind of relates to the same thing about recovery. So I was just with Jonathan Jad, and I cracked or dislocated a rib, which is very annoying.
So
I don't really know. You did too?
Surfing. And
yeah, it's still bulbed out, and I'm going to go get an x-ray, I think, tomorrow night.
Chad, sheesh. Jonathan, and I were surfing together, and I heard it pop.
Really well, mind and,
you. Yeah. We were incredible. And, yeah, incredible, yeah.
I actually went on a ride with like four doctors, and they all told me, like, some go, you can't dislocate a rib, and others go, you can totally dislocate a rib. And some go, it was cracked, and they said, either way, 4 to 6 weeks of being annoying. I can't take a deep breath, so I tried to go back into my build plan. You know, so for those who don't know, I just had surgery, and then we had a week of travel, and then I did this, so I can't go back into that. So what I did is I went back to traditional base, and I'm just trying to do, I think I'm in mid-volume, so it's like 90-minute endurance rides. I can do that, but it is so frustrating, like so frustrating. I was going so well.
Yeah, and here's where the subjectivity of all this comes into play. I think based on where Nate's touching his chest, I think we're injured in roughly the same spot. Maybe it's a little different, a little less severe in my case, but it hasn't hindered me at all. I mean, I can't cough. I can't sneeze. I just can't. I won't allow myself because it hurts too much. Sleep has been horrible.
That's self-control right there.
I can't find a comfortable position to sleep unless it's flat on my back and I try to draw shallow-ish breaths. However, I can get on the bike, and I've been doing, I'm testing out one of our upcoming training camps, the anaerobic camp, in preparation for a couple of really important races that are around the bend, and I can do it. I can, for whatever reason, in a hunched over position on the bike, I can draw full breaths. I can do a whole lot of work. I can still do bench presses and pull-ups, but I can't breathe very well. It sounds paradoxical, but for whatever reason, I haven't been hindered at all in terms of keeping my training on track.
It does feel better when I bend over. I showed my wife, I was like, hey, look at this, because one of my ribs is sticking out more. And she had to sit down because she was going to pass out.
Yeah, yours is definitely worse than mine.
Yeah, it's just, I've heard of like maybe a chiropractor trying to push it back in and that might reduce it. But then I read online, they're like, you might sedate people to do that. I'm like, I don't want that. So
go see a proper doctor and go from there.
I did see proper doctors, and they're just like, there's nothing we can do.
Oh, so there are injuries that have to do with like movement on the bike, like knee, ankle, hip, anything like that. And those ones can definitely get worse with the pedaling motion. With ribs, man, I almost hesitate to offer this advice. So, disclaimer, I grew up riding dirt bikes, which is a lot of us. We don't tend to be that smart, but we love turning throttles and going fast, and we crash a lot. And we had really bad advice that we used to give each other, and we, for some reason, thought that that was great advice. So I have broken plenty of ribs throughout the course of my life, and I always just kind of gritted through it. I never did something that would actually make it worse other than falling on it again. But breathing, riding, anything else like that, it didn't make the broken rib any worse. I've never dislocated one, but broken, yes. I've never made something that made it worse, but certainly the pain has made it so that it's been impossible to do something before. But that's one of those injuries that sucks because it hurts terribly. You can't do anything for it. But at the same time, you may, if you can tolerate the pain, you may be able to train through it.
What it comes down to is, primarily you're concerned with losing aerobic fitness. That's the one that takes the longest time to rebuild. So if you can do what Nate's doing and just get on the bike, and you know, it may not be as hard as what you were doing, you may notice you're losing some of your high end, and that's okay because you can get that back pretty quickly. Just make yourself do something. Try to maintain what you're doing, and a couple hours a week at you know, a moderate intensity, even a lower intensity, will do that effectively.
Easy mountain biking too doesn't hurt it, so that's kind of nice. As long as there's nothing too steep, that's great. I can just kind of plop around, and the suspension is enough. It's I'm the same way as Chad. It hurts more laying down on the bench to do bench press. That hurts a ton, but as soon as I get there, I can do bench press, and then getting up, I'm like, oh, this hurts so much. Just stay there.
And Bryce, your question follows along. You submitted a question that follows very similarly. I'll just read out the question, but hopefully it gives you the information you need. Chad, if you feel like there's any specific information we can add, we'll throw it in. But sure. Bryce's question was, following my half-distance triathlon A race this upcoming Sunday, which by this point you will have already completed it, what type of plan should I follow following the race in order to get back into race form as safely, quickly, and efficient as possible? So
Bryce, unless you're having a long layoff, you're going to stay in race-ish form. So you're just looking for maintenance. This is mostly going to depend, though, on when your next event is. So you kind of got to count back from there and decide how much time you have to bring your fitness up to what could be another peak. If you're looking to extend your peak, then you just kind of got to go into maintenance mode. So maybe your next race is only a couple weeks out, in which case I'd recommend whatever specialty plan you use, just take a look at those taper weeks because they contain just about everything you're going to need. You know, smaller, less intense, well, equally as intense, but shorter duration doses of stress that'll keep you sharp without burning you out. If you got more time though, then, you know, you might do a 4-week rebuild and then repeat a specialty plan, maybe just the specialty plan. It all depends on when that next event is.
Yeah, in general, a half distance try isn't, it's half the distance of an Ironman, but I would say it's less than half the stress on your body. And a week of like a taper plan, for me, I would do like, you know, it's a Sunday, I'd kind of take Monday off, maybe Tuesday easy, and then Wednesday I'd be ready to go again.
Jake, he says, hi guys, love the podcast. I reactivated my Trainer Road account now that the Kurt Kinetic InRide 2.0 is supported and I'm loving it. Keep up the great work. Cool. Good to have you back, Jake. He says, my question recently, I've been having a lot of trouble with saddle numbness when riding indoors on the trainer. I very rarely, if ever, have this issue when riding outdoors. Is this common? So let's touch on that point first for all of us. Saddle numbness inside but not outside. I have never had particular, like an increase in saddle numbness or any type of saddle issues inside compared to outside.
My only guess is for whatever reason, you're working a little harder outside. And when you work harder, you're taking some of the burden off your pelvis and just less weight on your sit bones, your hips. Other than that, I find that low intensity rides, I don't necessarily start to go numb, but I definitely get more uncomfortable in the nether regions mm-hmm. simply because I'm just not putting much weight on my legs. But that would be the outside of that, I think this is mostly about a fit issue.
And outside rides too, you're moving around a lot more. Mm-hmm. You're getting out of your saddle, you're standing up, and just that helps. The worst I've talked about before, the worst I ever had it, did a half Ironman, did a really good bike of like, I think it was 224 or something. I had a really long nose saddle because this was before they kind of had the big cutouts and the little short nose. And mm-hmm. I was always told just to go to one side of it. And I was numb for 2 days. It was like no feeling. It was crazy. Right? You don't want that. So my advice is to just go and a good shop will always have those demo saddles and just demo because it is different. Each one of us uses a different saddle and you cannot say, and it'll change too. I'll like one saddle for a couple of years and then it'll wear out mm-hmm. or something. And I don't know, I'll have to switch saddles. But
and then Jonathan, you can back this up. I think Specialized has got one of those little things that you sit on and it actually sees, you know, where your ischial tuberosities, your sit bones yeah. imprint so that you can get the proper width of your saddle. Is that Specialized?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they do. And I'll provide a ghetto hack for all of you that don't have a Specialized dealer, or there are a lot of Specialized haters out there. So if you just can't set foot inside of a Specialized dealership or a shop, this is a good way to get around it. Fill a Ziploc bag with flour or powdered sugar and then take all the air out of it. Make sure it's got a good amount so that it's like at least like an inch thick in a big Ziploc bag. Zip it shut, put it down on something flat and very hard like the wood floor or a hard bench, something of that sort. And then sit down, but make sure that when you're sitting down on it, make sure that your knees are higher than your hips, because that way what you'll do is you'll get more of an imprint from those sit bones, like Chad said, rather than getting, you know, soft tissue actually kind of smoothing that out. And then you just have to measure the distance between the center points of those imprints in that fabric, which is just what the Specialized little sitter butt measuring thing does. And then with that measurement, look up online and you can see what size or what width saddle you need. I was going to say that, Jake, you might have too narrow of a saddle. I know that I started out with a 130. That was too narrow for me and I was getting numbness. I went to a 143. It felt actually too wide at first, but the numbness went away. That really helped. Number two, I would pay attention to your pelvic rotation. I see a lot of people rotate their pelvis forward, especially, and this is very common for most riders, especially when you're riding hard, we tend to roll that pelvis forward We tend to sit further forward on the nose of the saddle. We tend to really, and that's when we get a lot of pain and numbness. So try to pay attention to that and try to keep your sit bones anchored rather than any type of soft tissue, anchored to the saddle there. Those would be my two points.
So Jake, what we're most concerned with is that you can bear weight where you're supposed to bear weight. And that's not on the pubic bone, that's back toward those sit bones. If you don't have a saddle that's wide enough, that's one issue. And also if you, like Jonathan mentioned, if you have a tendency to roll your hips forward rather than, quote, anchor your sit bones, then the weight shifts to places it ought not be. A blood supply becomes an issue and numbness starts to factor in. So it's really a matter of finding a saddle and a pelvic position that, and basically prevents these issues.
So the next point he says, is this purely an equipment or fit issue? I think we've probably answered that. But he says, if yes, do you have any recommendations on bike setup or saddle choice? I thought it'd be cool if we each shared the saddles that we use. I know, and then we have mountain bikes to TT bikes to road bikes here. So for myself on mountain bikes, I have the Specialized Phenom. That saddle, the new one, it has a shorter nose on it too, which is not only good because it doesn't catch your baggy shorts and throw you over the bars when you try to get back, but it is so comfortable. It's a really good saddle. Has a center cut out in the center there. I have that on my mountain bike. And then on the road bike, I have the Specialized Tope. However, I have the S-Works Tope on that one. I'm switching over to have the Phenom on my road bike too because I love that saddle so much. I go with a thin, a saddle with less padding because I have sensitive skin and I get chafed like crazy. So if I have a saddle that I'm sinking into a lot of material, then it's just more opportunity for that. So I always run one that the center cut out and that's thin and that has more of a flat profile rather than a rounded one. I just rode on Giant's saddles, Chad. I think that, mm-hmm. I don't know if you've used them, but they really impressed me too. I just rode one of those.
So the team saddle, I don't even know what it is other than that it's a Giant saddle and it has three different positions for a forward pelvis, backward. I'm not sure how you determine that. I just went with the neutral one because I wasn't sure how to determine that. And it's been a great saddle, I have to say, but my go-to saddle is still a Physique Ariane because I like a long saddle. I do a lot of fore aft shifting when I ride my bike. And for whatever reason, I just got lucky and the width of the saddle fits my body. There's no numbness, no pain at all. Even over longer rides. And then on my TT bike, had a lot of issues. I've tried many, many saddles. Landed on, I think it's the ISM, I think it's a PN 1.0. Either way, it's a split nose saddle and it's short and it's been awesome. So, but this just furthers the point that it's a real subjective thing. I mean, pelvic positioning is super important, but you also gotta try a lot of different saddles to find the ones that's just right for you.
Yeah, I've spent way too much money on saddles and over the years. Right now on the road bike, I have the Physique Antares, and I've tried the Arion, and I got numbness with that because everyone said, that's the best saddle. It didn't work out for me.
The Arion felt like a razor wrapped in sandpaper for me. It destroyed me. So
you're saying
so
you loved it.
My TT bike, I've gone through a bunch of ISM saddles, a ton, and try specific saddles. And the one that I like right now is a Specialized Hetero. It's not like, I'm not like, oh, this is Nirvana, this is it, like I am with my road saddle, but that's pretty good. It's definitely bearable. It's not very nice to say, but it's bearable. And then for my mountain bike, I don't really even know what the stock one came on my fat bike, but I don't even think about that saddle at all. And then Jonathan got me to buy the Phenom, the S-Works one, for my new sweet mountain bike that is sitting at the office, but there's no fork and there's no seat post. We're just waiting for those. It hurts every time I walk by it, but yes, that's what I have.
Yeah. The one thing that I would, try demo saddles. And also, if you look at the Pro Peloton, they use a lot of saddles that are unmarked, or a certain guy that rides for Trek, for example, may use a Specialized saddle or vice versa. Just be completely, don't be brand loyal, be loyal to yourself when it comes to a saddle. Pick the one that feels the best and allows you to ride most comfortably.
Same can be said for shoes.
Totally. Yep. Yeah. Saddle and shoes. That's your contact points are super important. I'm on a Yeti bike with a Specialized saddle, but it's all black, so no one knows, hopefully. Well, now you all know, so it's all out there. But
does Yeti make a saddle?
They do, in partnership with WTB, but I do not get along well with those WTB saddles. And a lot of mountain bikers use those because they come on a lot of bikes, but I'd encourage you, explore the space. Find out that there's more for you there. So just to wrap up his question here, he says, should I simply spend more time out of the saddle on a regular basis? This is something I struggle with on the trainer. As I come out of the saddle, it seems like I need to up. And first of all, I feel like if he's spending more time out of the saddle because he needs relief, that's probably a sign that he needs a different saddle or a different position. Yeah. He says, as I come out of the saddle, it seems like I need to upshift and increase my power output substantially to prevent pedal knocking. By knocking, I assume he's talking about that dead slack point halfway through the pedal stroke towards the bottom there that he has, due to spooling up the flywheel. I think the fact that the bike is locked upright with no side-to-side compliance also makes this difficult, certainly, but it's not something that can't be overcome. Any tips for transitioning out of the saddle and riding out of the saddle effectively during the workouts? Thanks, Jake.
Yeah, Jake, I've got a lot of tips on the on-screen text in many workouts addressing exactly this, because it's a pretty important topic, moving in and out of the saddle. I'll just distill it down to basically, gearing's going to matter a lot. If you're on a smart trainer, you kind of have to slow your spin before you rise. And if you're on a traditional trainer, I tick down two gears as I'm coming out of the saddle. So just as I start to rise, tick, tick, and that gear kicks in by the time I'm standing, and that kind of smooths out that transition. And then it's just a question of practice. And as you practice, you'll find a spot where you're neither too far forward nor too far back. And you'll know you're too far forward because all your weight's on your hands, and your hands will get a little sore or just a little heavy. Too far back and your quads are still loading up. So you just find that position where you're neither too far forward, too far back. And then just try to become fluid. And that's just a matter of practice. And this is where, and I don't want to bring up the whole weight training thing, but this is where a strong body comes into play. I mean, if you don't have a whole lot of central strength or you know, usable general strength, it's learning to ride out of the saddle is going to be a taller order than it will be for someone who has a, in general, stronger body.
In general, though, Chad, if he's getting numbness on an hour-long trainer ride, it's probably time to demo new saddles, right?
Absolutely, yeah. If pain in your undercarriage is actually forcing you out of the saddle, then standing is not the solution.
Yeah, and another thing too I've noticed is that with the Quare bib shorts, what brand? We have the gold, right?
Gold is their highest, yep.
Yeah. And then we have the thinner pad, is that right?
Yep. Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, it's got a thinner chamois in it. It's nice.
Yeah.
Well, it's not particularly thin, I should say. It's just compared to other brands, it's not like a pillow, you know.
I just noticed those two things together. Like, I don't think it's all saddle, or your chamois does have a lot to do with it.
It factors into it, but that's another band-aid. If you're relying on a thicker chamois to keep you comfortable in the saddle longer, and it still comes back to, you know, bike fit, your position on the saddle itself.
The other thing to say is if you're new to cycling, an hour on the trainer is going to hurt no matter what.
Oh, yeah.
Especially totally. if you're heavier.
That's real.
Like we had a guy before who was, if you're 260 and you're new and you're not putting out many watts, it's going to be hard at first, and your butt's going to get tightened up. But you don't want numbness, like pinching of nerves. That's like two different things, right? Your sit bones are sore versus
for sure,
I'm cutting off blood flow somewhere.
Yeah, there's an adaptive period, but if you're getting numbness or, you know, any radiant pain or like numbness that happens when you're off the bike, that's especially of concern. So none of those things are acceptable.
Yeah, and two really quick things before we close off on this one. Number one, if you are heavier, look into a carbon fiber saddle. They tend to be stiffer. Because if your saddle is flexing and giving in the center too much, most saddles are designed to flex a little bit there. But if it's giving too much, that can put a lot of undue pressure in different areas. It can just increase the surface area that you have with your saddle, and that can be bad. Number two, always remember that because you're inside, you don't have the distractions of riding outside. Many times, we also tend to focus on the discomfort that we feel. And lend it more discomfort than is actually than what we would when we're outside too. So hopefully that gives you all the info you need on that one. That wraps it up for this week, guys. That was a lot of questions we ripped through. So thanks so much for joining us and submitting your questions to us. You can do so, remember, at trainerroad.com/podcast. There's a form right there. You can enter in your questions, and we sort through and comb through as many as we can each week. And we try to pick out the ones that will provide the most benefit for everyone. And we'll answer them on the next episode. You can find and share this podcast from iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever else you're listening to your podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.